This is Series 3 of Brave New You Tribe, and I'm Lou Hamilton, co-founder with Meredith Heppner Chapman of the clothing brand Brave New You. We welcome you to the stories of real-life Brave New Girls who are creatives, brand builders, entrepreneurs, health practitioners, and campaigners who have the courage to overcome challenges, push the envelope, and envision impactful possibilities for the future. This week's guest is broadcast journalist and author Dr. Mandeep Rai, who takes us on a journey to 101 countries around the world, highlighting a single unique value that has defined each nation's history, culture, and global influence. In her new book, The Values Compass, she shows us how we can apply values to better our own lives and make decisions more effectively. Welcome, Mandeep, to Brave New You Tribe. Hi, Mandeep. How are you?
I'm very well, Lou. Thank you for having me. It's great to see you as well as hear you.
I'm really excited to have you on. I'm going to start off by reading out the feedback from the Dalai Lama about your book. So what he says is, the values compass takes us into the hearts, minds, and traditions of the cultures and people of the world. It demonstrates how interconnected we are and how the divisions that exist between us stem from acting with narrow self-interest rather than concern for the good of our human family. I hope that the book will contribute to making our world a happier place. I'm really interested in this interconnectivity because, you know, this global pandemic that we're experiencing right now is kind of one of the first things that the whole world has experienced at the same time, with the same risk, but different countries have responded in different ways. And I wonder whether, you know, what you've explored in terms of each country having its own value, whether that has actually shown up in how they've responded to the pandemic.
Great question. And the short answer would be very much so, in that I could never have predicted the pandemic. So the book doesn't address the pandemic in any way. It came out the 7th of January 2020, and by kind of end of January we were getting to learn about the coronavirus, and by February kind of events started to become cancelled, and you know, we were in lockdown by March. And what I found is that the way countries were responding was in line with their values, even though that's not anything that I could have predicted. And I think that's because the way I've come about finding these values are that I've just been a fly on the wall in all the different places and countries that I've been to, really absorbing and then putting on kind of an understanding, investigating, researching, and thinking, why is it the way it is? Why am I seeing what I'm seeing? And a part of it would be academic. Another part of it would be by talking to many, 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 many people across different strata of society. And another part of it would be just, I guess, seeing whether this held true given the context, given the geography, the history, the politics. Could it be explained? Is there a reason for it? And so when you look at how, for example, Italy responded to the virus, which was, the value for Italy is care, like this attention to detail, being able to really put themselves into the detail so that they look after the complete picture. So, for example, they'll say, oh, don't go to the beach without a little, you know, don't go outside without a little neck garb, just protect yourself from the wind. Or, you know, you wouldn't step out the door without a bit of lipstick. Or, you know, just make sure that your shoes match your belt, match your, you know, that's the least you can do. Even if you're putting the rubbish out, you can make that little bit of effort. It's that kind of thinking, oh, there's a hook for the shoes under your, you know, that chair you use on the sunbed. There's a hook for your flip-flops under the sunbed. When I'm in Italy during the pandemic, I was there this summer. Suddenly I realized that actually I don't even have to touch the taps. You know, there's a pedal sometimes for the hot water and the cold water. And you think, oh, that's so clever in terms of sanitation or, you know, being sanitized. There's even a pedal sometimes to open doors, or there's a bidet so you're not worried whether the toilet roll's running out or not. And so I just found that during the pandemic, the way Italians, one, there was a sense of care, wanting to look after their whole entire family, wanting to make sure, you know, the older generation as well as the younger generation was okay. Maybe that interactivity is the reason it spread the way it did. But then there was also a very kind of attention to detail, caring way in which they looked after that situation, such that they're not on the quarantine list. You can go to Italy and at least over the summer, you didn't have to spend 2 weeks quarantining on either side, because no matter where you went, people wore their mask, people sanitized, like, you know, used hand sanitizer every time they walked into a building, every time they walked out of a building. You wouldn't even go and get a nice, you know, get a gelato without your mask, because one, you could be fined 1,000 euros and the person who's serving you could be fined. But it wasn't just the penalty. It was the fact that they felt as though the whole world was watching and their reputation was at risk, and they were not going to become that kind of laissez-faire, we don't care, you know, our liberty comes first. It was like they took it really seriously. China, extremely pragmatic. The way that they dealt with this is such that they emerged almost, you know, very quickly, such that their cases dropped down and they had COVID-free parties. They have had pool parties now to celebrate the fact that they, you know, that the virus basically is not there. And they've managed to do this because when it mattered, they were extremely strict. It didn't matter. You know, they weren't having questions about the economy or freedom or should we or shouldn't we. There were no debates. It was just like, We know what this is. We know what's required. PPE everywhere. We're going to be almost kind of blanket about this and be extremely pragmatic and get the job done. So, and I can take you through other countries. So, for example, England, this kind of steadfast, like, keep calm, carry on. Let's just see how long we can keep, you know, everything open. Let's not panic. And even though everyone else around us was like going into lockdown, closing, not traveling or shutting their airports or testing vigilantly, you know, England had this attitude of, let's just wait and see, let's just keep calm, let's just, but just this kind of methodical step by step. I see you laughing. It's this, you know, every country had its own way of dealing with it. America was extremely kind of entrepreneurial, stroke pivot is the value for America. One minute they think it doesn't matter, or their leadership thought it didn't matter. The next minute it was like 180 shift. You know, okay, well, this is the way we're going to deal with it. And it's just being able to shift very quickly, depending on the information that they get or depending on what their view is at that time. And not apologizing for yesterday, but just getting on with today. Today is what, you know, now this is our strategy, for example. So just to reiterate, although I couldn't have predicted any of their reactions, I guess the study and the study of how their values had evolved to what they are, or what I saw them to be, is not a surprise that you saw those values also play out this year, as you will see them play out next year and the year after. That's not to say we don't evolve or that countries don't educate themselves or change. They do. And there has been a shift of values even during the pandemic. But we have a certain way of being, and there's some certain ways that have served us well, that we adapt to the situation, but we use that value that serves us well.
I find it absolutely fascinating that a whole country can be sort of identified by one value. And as I'm sort of working my way through the book, it's just so interesting kind of seeing what value emerges from what country and how sort of egalitarian suddenly it feels that, you know, a little tiny country has this strong value that in terms of a value against value, they're sort of equal. So you can compare one value of Paraguay against a value of the United States, and one value is no less or more than the other. So suddenly the whole world feels very sort of egalitarian in terms of their values. And you've definitely marked the values as positive, although of course each value has its shadow. but I'm sort of intrigued by, obviously, a country is made up of millions of people and individuals who have their own set of values. So I'm wondering what your value is and how you've used your value to get through a lockdown, which is something new to us all. It's almost like imprisonment, isn't it? So how has that helped you or hindered you?
I want to applaud you for understanding the book so well, to see that value of egalitarianism across the countries. You're right. I really don't believe that any country is better or worse than any other country. You're right that all of these values are positive values, because values inherently are positive, and that was the aim. And you're right that every value can have a shadow side. Anything in extreme can definitely also be negative. But that the aim here was, just as you picked up on Paraguay, what do we know that's positive about Paraguay or Papua New Guinea or Peru or Portugal? And why don't we know something positive? And I think that the aim of the book was to show you almost the gem, the jewel, the gift that each and every place or each and every society has to offer us. So my aim was not to say everyone in Paraguay is X or everyone in Peru is Y. That's not the aim. The aim is simply to show you something inspirational that perhaps could be relevant or helpful or guide you to be another tool in your toolbox, if you choose it to be. So onto your question about what are my values and how have they helped me in lockdown. So ironically, one of my strongest, biggest, most important values is freedom. So it's funny that you called lockdown, you said it was synonymous to prison. So I almost refuse to use the word lockdown. It does not gel with my values and it doesn't make me feel good. So I adopted the word that I heard a lot in Singapore called circuit breaker. And I just thought, okay, this is just here to break any routine that I might have had, which in fact helps freedom, right? Because you're breaking any habits, norms, that's great. And then that period that we're allowed to go outside to exercise, I would relish that. And I do relish that even now, even whilst we're in our circuit breaker period now. And so every morning I am out, and I'm out not only doing the school run, but I'm also out to run, to feel that sense of freedom, to feel wind in my hair, to still cycle, to still do things that really allow me to breathe and not feel as though I'm being caged. So I think that we have all found different ways of meeting our needs. So for example, if your need is connectivity and you're not able to go out and connect and have kind of meetups in the way you did or see people in the way you did, then you found that people instantly thought, okay, we're just going to use technology and we've just had Diwali. And, you know, people just had Zoom parties on, you know, to celebrate Diwali. Whatever it be, we would do in order to connect. And you found that there's a ton of innovation happening so that people meet the needs that they have. So I feel that this period has only just allowed us to think more inventively about, one, what our values are, and two, how to have them met.
And I think when you take the time to understand what your values are, it's sort of, I believe our values are sort of like our DNA in a way. They're so integral to what matters to us. You know, they are, that we say, our core values, and you know, that's what we are to our very core. And then when we know that, then our decisions, our ways of responding can be sort of geared by that. So mine is most definitely, one of them is connection. So, you know, immediately the first circuit breaker, I pivoted our podcast from being a live event to being recorded. And so every week through this last 9 months, however long it's been, I've spoken to a new person, quite often someone I don't know, often in another part of the world. And I've had the kind of connections with people that I would never have had before. But because I knew that connection was so important to me, I made sure that that was happening in some way or another. So I'm intrigued to sort of know your past, how you came eventually to be writing this book. It's been a wiggly road. It often is a wiggly road, isn't it? So where did it all begin?
I love the fact that we could utilize, you know, your experience in terms of how you got to this podcast as a way of you meeting your values. So I, you know, to do this on a weekly basis and to really pivot. So thank you for verifying. Okay, where to begin? Where would you like me to begin?
You grew up in a small town in Gloucestershire, and you said that your house was petrol bombed, and that your mum and dad, when they had to go out, they didn't want to leave the house alone. So one would go in, would hide in the trunk of the car. To me, that's something huge is happening there in terms of, you know, your values are not being honoured, and somebody else's values, how can they treat you like that? What values would they have that they would be able to do that to another human being in their own community? So maybe we can start there.
Wow. You've touched on a period of my life that was, very challenging. And it's true. I remember we lived this part of Gloucestershire. Actually, it was a village. It's a village called Churchdown. And within this church town, there was we didn't know it was rough at the time, but it was a council estate. So you can assume it's going to be quite, you know, possibly rough. Anyway, it turned out to be, according to the police, it was the most dangerous council estate in the whole of Europe. That's what they said to us when we asked for a bit of protection. And they said, even though the police station actually was right next to the council estate, they said, we're too scared to come in, let alone protect you. So, you know, you're by yourselves. So my parents owned a shop. It's the reason we were there. And because people lived quite hand to mouth, the corner shop worked. And there was a park right in front of the house. And I remember when we first moved into the area, we were the only non-white people. As far as the eye could see, I never saw anyone of any other kind of ethnicity at that time. And there was a huge party took place in the park opposite our house. And a massive sign was made, which said, get out, you packies. And a petrol bomb came through the letterbox and bricks came through the window. That was like within the first few weeks of us moving in. And my parents immediately, when the police said what they said, and they said, you know, what do you expect? This is like the roughest area you could have moved into. My parents put bars on the window. So after that, like I remember a brick smashing my mother, you know, smashing into my mother's head, like while she's standing in her own living room. And so as these bars went up, you could think of it similar to a lockdown. You're being caged, you're in prison. And yes, you're right that every time my parents went out, they would, one of them would hide into the boot of the car if we ever had to go out as a family. We would never, ever, ever go out as a family. The one occasion we did, and it was visible because my parents were dressed up, it was for my mother's brother's wedding. And the wedding was being held in Cheltenham. And so as a family, we had dressed up. There was like, you know, this was like a huge occasion. And as soon as the estate found out, the whole house was ransacked. We had a guard dog, and they drugged the guard dog, and they took everything we could have put ever, like everything. They even slashed the mattresses. Now you could think, oh, to answer your question about how have their values allowed this to happen, or how could I understand this? Well, I remember this one incident where walking to school, I was tripped up by one of my classmates. It was a little boy, and we were walking to primary school. And when I got to school, there was blood everywhere because my nose, as I was tripped up, my nose smashed onto the pavement. And it was beyond a nosebleed. I think I broke the bone of my nose broke. And the teacher, as soon as she saw me, and she said, what happened? And she said to him, why did you do this? And he said, oh, I just wanted to see if her blood was brown or black. Or like he had never, from his point of view, he'd never seen someone like me. He'd never seen a colored person. So he was genuinely like, is her blood going to be colored as well? Is her blood going to be a different color? So in some respects, on one hand, there was this kind of genuine curiosity stroke ignorance stroke, you know, we've never seen a family like you. We've never known. All we know is Paki. We don't really know India. We don't, you know, we smell curry, we don't know it's turmeric. It's like, it's all these, nuanced, just not knowing. And then on the other hand, I think it was just, who do you think you are that you should live in this area, that you have come to Britain? And they don't know about, you know, I don't think necessarily they were that well educated or knew about the British Raj and how England had spent, you know, how many British people were in India at the time, and how during the First World War and the Second World War. I'm a Sikh. We are 2% of India's population, but in the army, we are 22%. And so during the World Wars, you know, I'm now third generation, my children are fourth generation. My grandparents came here in the 1940s when the World Wars were such that we were all fighting together, you know, similar to the coronavirus, you're in it together and you're fighting for the same cause. And you're then building the country, as in they were asked to then stay on and work in the coal mills and work in the Black Country. This is in the Midlands. And, you know, literally the slogan was, let's build the country back up together. So they don't know any of this history. They don't know anything about you. They can just see that you are on their turf. And I think even though that was, like, even if I think about it now, I know it's hurtful, but it also made me understand that everyone has different points of view, that there is no real truth, that my truth is X, their truth is Y, that I think I can just see it from their point of view just as much as I can see it from my own, and that we're all fed a completely different history, or often very different versions of history. So from their point of view, they're right, and from my point of view, I'm right, and all it takes is understanding one another and dialogue, and really understanding each other's values. So their values at that time might have been to protect their turf, or to kind of, you know, belonging. They may want to have belong with one another and not have outsiders, or what they perceived as outsiders. They don't know that you've been here since the 1940s, or that their country has been in your country for the last 200-300 years, or that you've had all this history, or that there's a reason for it and actually you were asked to come and help, or that you fought in the war together, or any of this.
If you're looking at the shadow of a value, then that would be, so for England, you know, if everything is on the straight and narrow and steadfast, then we're not very good at looking at difference, at looking a bit at embracing change, at being open to other ideas. How do you help people to sort of look past the more negative side of their values?
So I'll look at the positive side first, in the sense that that value of steadfastness also helped me and my family. We didn't just run away. We didn't just pack up our bags and leave. You know, we were there for many, many years. We moved there when I was 7. I lived there all the way until I left for university. So this kind of keep calm, carry on, be steady, you know, just we're in it for the long haul. We'll do it together, to the point that those same people over years began to then kind of speak to my father differently. You know, there was like bonds were built, changes happened. And I think there was a much greater understanding over the course of time. I was reading recently with my son, and there was this kind of like caricature of an Indian corner shop comes up in lots of children's books and in lots of, you know, popular culture too. And it really, I think it became kind of a fabric of British society. So even though we think we're not very good at adapting, or we're not very open, there has been an embrace and openness. And I think that actually Britain is probably one of the most, at least London and Birmingham and Manchester and any of these, you know, big cities, are probably one of the most cosmopolitan, multiracial places on the planet. You don't have to come to England and suddenly become English or British, right? You can actually still speak whatever language you speak. You can still wear whatever garb you were wearing. And actually, as I traveled the world and began to see how some in some places when you move, you have to assimilate and you almost have to become wherever, you know, call yourself of that nation, speak a different language, not have an accent. There's all these different things. So I think let's give some credit where it's due, but also there is another part aside where I think, yes, change has been really slow. For example, we've just celebrated Diwali, and for the first time in my whole entire life, have I seen Diwali become completely recognized. And I think it really made a difference that Rishi Sunak went outside of number 11 and lit those candles. It was a 1 minute video and it made such a difference to how people now perceive, you know, the festival that Hindus see as their beginning of their year. So it's, so I think that change is happening, will happen, and hopefully will continue to happen, so that no matter where you live, if you live in that country, you can call it home. No matter where you live, no matter where you were born, no matter who you are, you can rest your head. Wherever you are resting your head, that can be your home.
So you left home, you found your freedom, went out into the world, you studied philosophy, politics and economics, and then did an MSc at the London School of Economics, and then an MBA at the London Business School, a year at Harvard Business School and MIT, and you hold a PhD in global values. And you started your career in private banking and then moved more into the sort of world of grassroots NGOs and looking kind of in a wider way, at people and people's behaviours. How did you sort of then find yourself becoming a very well-travelled journalist and then thinking about these issues that you've come to write about?
Again, I'm going to commend you for the research you've done, for knowing so much and for knowing this wiggly path so well. You're right that I intertwined private banking or venture capital or business and finance with social impact, NGOs, but also the UN, the EU, with international journalism and media. And I think what I learned from my first job immediately at JP Morgan, that actually, I remember one time I came up with an idea of helping our clients invest in funds that basically have impact, that do good. And I guess I was maybe 20 years ahead of my time, because the banker I was working for said, "Mandeep, if you want to work for the charitable part of the bank, why don't you go and work for the charitable part of the bank? But we're not a charity here." And I said, "No, I'm not saying let's be charitable. I'm just saying where we invest our money can actually also have some social good. It can have social good, it can have environmental good, it can have technological good." And at the time, Bluetooth was just being formed. And I said, for example, and I put this whole presentation together to the senior class of the bank and said, even just if we invest in this technology, which I'm sure will become ubiquitous, that in itself will do some good. And they kind of looked at me as if, you know, like, are you sure you want to be in a bank? And I think immediately I thought, okay, what is it that's driving me here? Why am I trying to essentially have a positive impact, make the world a better place? I wanted kind of my day to day to lead us all into a better world. And hence I didn't deliberately shift. I took a sabbatical and was almost found by journalism and media. This extraordinary story happened, which I can share with you. But ultimately, the point is that I found that when I told certain stories, like, for example, with the BBC World Service or with Reuters on television or radio, that had people thinking and that made impact. Well, I tried to see, well, what would it be like to, for example, get a master's and work for the UN? So I went and got a master's in development economics and went to work for the UN. And I found that I wasn't able to make the kind of impact that I was hoping to make in a larger organization. So I thought, okay, well, what if I work for more grassroots organizations? What if I'm on, you know, I remember my first NGO assignment in Uganda. It was called the Memory Project. And the aim was that there were so many orphans where both, you know, their parents were dying of AIDS. And these orphans didn't even necessarily know who they could trust, where their land was, which cattle is theirs, before it's kind of swiped and gone, and these kids are left with nothing. And so the aim was for these parents to write like these memory logs, or these memory books they were called, and to make sure that the child had it and knew, this is your family, this is your, you know, we're not here, but these are your roots, and this is, these are the people you can trust or rely on, you know, this is your kind of safety net, so as to speak. So I found that kind of work really rewarding, but I still felt media had a bigger impact. So I was trying to combine the two in my journalism. So there was always this kind of social human interest element where often I would work as well as do the journalism. And then I was asked to basically, after all of that TV, radio, everything, I was asked to set up a media venture capital fund within the Middle East. And it was just around 9/11. And I saw so much hurt during 9/11. I was reporting for Reuters. I was in New York. And it wasn't just Muslim brothers and sisters who were being attacked. Sikh people were being attacked because Sikhs wear turbans. Anyone really of any ethnicity was really seen with suspicion. But for sure, the Islamic community and Muslims around the world were really hurting. And so as a Sikh, you stand up for the person being oppressed, so as to speak. And so when this opportunity came to work in the Middle East to change, hopefully change the way people perceive Islam or the Muslim community or the Middle East generally through media, which I know can be done, so that we have powerful stories coming. Like, who's do you know of any Middle Eastern superheroes, for example? We only know about maybe 1001 Arabian Nights or something. You know, they were, even in the Middle East, they were consuming Hollywood and Bollywood. Where were their own stories? Where were their own, like, what about all the beauty that is in that region? And so we started to invest in all kinds of things, from theme parks to amazing books to films, and, you know, it was a plethora of literature. Like, we just wanted to really explore and share this with the world. And that's when I thought, this is great. I have unlimited potential here, but maybe some grounding with an MBA would be helpful. And so that's kind of where the business rigor came back in. And I think that during all of that, the truth is that as I was doing whatever I was doing, I would write these emails back to my friends and family and say, this is what I've really been moved by. Or this is, you know, the way the Japanese practice respect. We can really learn something from this. Or the vision that is coming out of the United Arab Emirates. Like, the, you know, they already project and they already decide, okay, 2030 is going to look like this, 2050 is going to look like this. We could have a oil-free, like, completely alternative energy city built. Let's do, you know. And so wherever I was, I would share these gems. And when I fell pregnant, I was speaking to a very good friend of mine at the BBC, and he said, what about bringing all those gems together and sharing it to the next, for the next generation? And as that was 10 years ago, and as I began to think about that, and in fact, I started writing immediately, I began to realize that actually these gems were values, and that sharing them is one thing. I could take you around the world and share them, but actually, if I was really to be credible, I need to put some more rigor behind it. Hence the PhD, hence like the fact that it took me 10 years to really give the book the weight that I wanted to give it, to have it such that it's applicable to business leaders as well as the next generation, to have it so that anyone who picks up the book can think, okay, what out of all the possible values in the world, what really matters to me? What is the legacy that I really want to leave? Or what would I want said at my eulogy? Or how should I be spending my time if I've chosen these few things? So the book is a process, I guess, similar to the process that I went through. And rather than you having to go through a myriad of different jobs to get to your values, this is a quick kind of 15, 20 minute process that helps you figure out what it is that you really stand for. And you know what these things are, because when they're violated, wow, you suddenly are very aware of them. But we can go through life you know, dealing with this kind of in our subconscious, but not really being aware of it. Yet if you're aware of it, if you're aware of your work values, then how you make decisions really changes. The speed at which you make decisions changes, the clarity with which you make decisions, how you make decisions changes. And you're able to, going back to your Dalai Lama quote, lead a life of greater success, fulfillment, and happiness, because it is in line with what really matters to you. A value is what you value.
I like the way that each chapter talks about sort of important things that have happened to a country, you know, important people, events, sort of cultural issues. So you kind of have a sort of a nugget of what that country is about, and a little kind of snapshot of interesting, important things about the country that then kind of emerges into to its value. And then at the end, you slightly turn it around. So you say, so these are the things that you can pick up from this country and look to yourself and see whether this value can help you in some way, whether it touches you in some way. A few years back, I worked a lot with values and teaching people to find their values. And we'd start with sort of, okay, so what are your top 30 values? And then people would find that quite easy, and then narrow it down to 10. That would be a bit harder. And then say, okay, so it's not to say that any of these that you can't have, but we're now going to narrow it down to 3. What are those 3 top values? And people found that incredibly hard. And it took time, and over time they'd go, oh, well, maybe actually that's not quite the strongest. Maybe what really defines me is this one or this one. But then when you did have that, and you could almost make a sentence, like a mission statement from those, using those 3 words. And you're right that, you know, when you have that, you feel that as your sort of backbone, that every decision you make, every choice that comes along, you go, well, does this match my values? And if it doesn't, okay, I'm not doing that. That's not the path I'm going to follow. So it does make life so much easier when you know those things and take the time to find what they are. So as a mother, do you look to that with your children?
I just want to praise you for making that so simple, because that's exactly what that process you went through is exactly what the book does. And you're right that it becomes your backbone, and then life is so much better. So almost, if we were to just take exactly what you said and put it right at the beginning of the podcast, or right at the beginning of the book, that is kind of the summary of it all. Do I practice this with my children? My children are now 9 and 8 years old, and we're at a stage where they're very opinionated, and they have very clear values themselves. So what we do is kind of like regularly have these family sessions. So you can do this, you should do this for yourself, but you can also do this in any organization. The schools we have chosen for them are based on the values of those schools. And you see how it's being played out in their education. You see, for example, that teamwork will be really emphasized and praised and, you know, questioned where it's lacking. And that there's an emphasis, for example, on teamwork in one of the schools, and how that changes the way that they then view everything. So similarly, as a family, we look at what are our family values. And so each of my children will say, well, Mama, this is what I think is really important right now. So one of them is very focused on the environment. And that doesn't just mean planting trees, although that's what his birthday was about. It doesn't just mean adopting the tiger or a leopard, but we have done that. It means like everything, like milk doesn't come in plastic cartons anymore. The milkman delivers in glass bottles. Everywhere that he sees that we could be better, he pulls us up on it, because he's made it clear that this is really important to him. And we could do better, and he's right. So but equally, if one of them, for example, values fun, then, and as a family, you've come up with your top 3 or your top 5, then what your weekend looks like, or what your time together looks like, should reflect something that really, that is important to all of you, or matches what is important to each, you know, at least one value per person. so that there's less frustration, there's a greater harmony, and you understand where the other person is coming from. I can understand that if there isn't an element of fun over the weekend, I totally get that that would be, why are we living, frankly, would say my other son. So
why are we saving the planet? For what if it's all boring?
Exactly. There's got to be fun. I was like, okay, I get that. So we're adding the fun. So, I think it's really helped us communicate and kind of meet our needs. But much more importantly, this, even though I had this idea while I was pregnant, and I really thought that I'd be able to knock it out within the 9 months that, before the baby came out, the book would be ready. Since then, every single week, we focus on a different value. We have these like values classes at home, and pre-circuit breaker, 30 to 50 kids would pile into the house, and we segment them in different ages, and the elder groups help the younger children, and they focus on a different value every week and think about how it should that manifest, how would it be practiced, what does it feel like when that doesn't exist, and they really kind of are embedded in, for example, the value of friendship or compassion or empathy or kindness, like you name it. Like every week it's a different thing for them to really feel, embody the gift of that value and to share that further.
I want to be in your values gang.
You're welcome. You don't live so far, we can make it happen.
So do you do one for grown-ups? I know that you do actually go into businesses and look at this as a sort of, it's vital, isn't it? It's really key to relations and, relations between people in a business or within a country or within a community or between countries. And never more so we needed that. So what's your vision for the future using values?
I think that I've seen a real shift in the course of this year. I think what could have taken 5, 6 years or even 10 years to happen happened within 6 weeks. Leaders who are not listening or who don't have a sense of compassion or aren't being collaborative are not going as far as those that are. What we expect of our leaders and what we want being really well defined right now. And I think that there's been a shift towards like we cannot be competitive, we need to be collaborative. So for example, with this vaccine, the first question that's being asked is, will it be available to all? Will everyone be able to afford it? Can health be for everyone? And I find that with the younger generation especially, they are so much clearer about their values. They would rather not work than work for an organization that doesn't, that doesn't stand for what they believe in. And even in terms of their buying power, they would happily pay 50% more if their values are being met. So whether it be sustainable or whether it be environmental values or whether it be about doing social impact or social good, you are seeing it a lot within the younger generation. So I'm really hopeful for our future. And I think that as this conversation takes place further and further, we are going to see a real shift. We have just set up, along with the G20 was happening in Saudi Arabia this year. And for the very first time ever, we've just created the V20, the Values 20, which will happen kind of synonymously at the same time as the G20 from now on. And so already I am seeing that the conversation that we're having, I feel like there's a real yearning. I've seen a yearning in companies to do this more and more. And for leaders of countries are being elected on their values. So everything we do is according to our values, but it just wasn't in our vernacular. We weren't so aware that this is what it was based on. And I think that awareness is only ever going to be increasing. And I'm here to serve in that mission.
I'd say that this podcast's value was courage. It's about honouring the people who I interview who have some way shown courage through what they do, through their work, through their lives, overcoming adversity, rising up when, maybe they thought that they would never get up again, doing things that are hard. So I feel that the real life Brave New Girls that come on the podcast show courage. And I ask them what courage means to them. But I've never thought of it as a value as such. So I'd be interested to know what you thought about that as a value and how you would define it.
I think it's most definitely a value. I remember when I was younger, really when I was separating myself from being guided to guiding myself. So there was this pivotal moment when I was 18 where my mother, who had experienced all this kind of racism, for lack of a better word, when she learned that I got a place at the University of Oxford, she said, "Oh, and now you'll marry Sebastian and now you'll become one of these kind of," she said, "I won't be able to speak Punjabi to my children, grandchildren. You'll join this community that frankly don't even like us." She was talking about the kind of white community that we were surrounded by. "And if I'm your mother, I ask you just one thing, accept any of the other universities that have offered you a place, just don't take Oxford." And it was really a moment where my mother's was my best friend. Like, I had really held her hand and she had held mine and had my back throughout this whole kind of journey that I had described to you. So I didn't want to disobey or not listen to her at this point. And then as soon as I turned down the place, I thought, wow, actually, I really do need to just, even though we both want the same thing for me, we both want kind of the best for me, a definition of it in terms of values is very different. And so every single time after that, I had to take courage to do what I thought would be better as opposed to just keep on listening. So I remember at that point almost thinking, I'm not sure I'm going to ask for permission anymore. I'm just slowly going to stand up for myself more and more and more in every decision I make. And we all know that what that feels like. We might be in a relationship where we need to do that, or we might be in an institution. Like, we all have to do that at different times, right? You do have to do that in the classroom, you have to do that at work, you have to do that in different contexts. And I know that all of you, as you're listening, will have an image of times that you've had to have that courage. And I think that the courage is to know what's right for you, or know what's right in a particular situation, or know what's working or not working, and not to to be able to stand for that in a way that is most as effective as it can be within the context that you're in. That, I feel, for me, that is courage.
Thank you. That's a really great definition of courage. And it's really interesting that that's your definition. And I love to hear everybody's unique definition of what courage is. And it helps all of us to look at that value as something that we can take on in ourselves. I'd really like to thank you for taking us on really a whistle-stop tour of the world to understand how the different countries have their own unique value system and how we can look at our own personal values to help us navigate our own lives better. So I really thank you. I've read the book on Kindle. I've been listening to it, but now I need to go and buy it in the flesh because I want to keep going back and referring to the different values so that I can take more on in my own life. So thank you very much, Mandeep.
You're very, very welcome. I really love this question of courage and that you stand for courage. I think that there's almost no greater value than courage, because courage is like pushing yourself more and more in every step, always thinking, what did yesterday look like? What could I have learned? What could I do better? Even if it's just 1%. And courage is like stepping into that every single time. And we have opportunities for it all the time. And it's just about whether we're going to choose to take it or not. So you've really, in this interview, had me remember all those times, but more importantly, that each of us, we couldn't stop, because the sweetness that you get from courage, right? The improvement that you get, the closer that you get to your own involvement and those around you, is so worth it. So thank you for taking us on this journey and for this remarkable conversation.
Thank you so much. And I look forward to meeting you in the flesh when we're out of this circuit breaker. Take care and see you soon.
See you. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mandeep, for your insights on values and how we can use them to make better decisions by coming from what matters most at our core. You can find out more about Mandeep's work on www.mandeep-rai.com or follow her on Instagram at Mandeep Rai. Thanks also to Podstar PR for producing the series, and to you, our tribe, for listening. Download, rate and review on your podcast provider so that we can keep bringing you this free podcast. Goodbye for now and see you next time.